Testing, testing. One, two, three.
Take two, you're gonna go next thing.
We won't be able to take action on the Senate side today because the Senate will not be maintaining a quorum here apparently.
This bill is passed the Senate anyway, right?
No, it's in the House.
Oh, I'm sorry, we could change the order. I see, all right.
You wanna take 300?
No, let's do 269 first.
All right. Whenever you're ready, Frank, I'll say a few brief things. We have some real experts here.
Okay, we're ready with the tape now, Lou.
We're ready.
Fine, I'll take it from the governor.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. Senate Bill 269. Let me just start by saying, well, first of all, we've got our statewide director of elections, Mrs. Patty Ann Polly, who is here, and she's brought along some things that may be of value to join the hearing. I'm sure they will be. And old Richard Peter is here from the Attorney General's Office. I asked him to come along because he was the principal drafter of these two bills, 269 and 300. And undoubtedly, there'll be questions that he can best answer. And Mary Coffey is here from Anchorage, in charge of elections, among other things, and other experts are with us too. Mr. Chairman, right after the election, well, in fact, even before the last election, there were a lot of people who were a little bit distressed that the punch card operation was being handled through regulations and a procedures manual, a copy of which I have here somewhere, and that it was all a little bit informal. And it was my feeling, and I think many others join me in this, I know without any question, that we should put into the statute the procedures just as we've done for paper balloting regarding punch cards. Just for example, one thing, there was no provision in Title 15 for removing any ballot boxes from the precincts until the count and canvass was accomplished, simply because the title did not address itself to this punch card type of operation. And as you all know, those ballot boxes had to be taken to the computer centers. And so that was all handled by regulation. And it was all kind of loose. And so we spent a great deal of time right after coming on board here in getting together the election people and talking things over. And out of our discussions has come 269 and 300. You may have some specific questions about 269. I think, again, in general, what we have done, we have taken what was being done through the procedure process and through regulation and put it in the code. And we've also, I believe it's this bill that gives the parties a definite say as to who is going to be appointed to be on the election board. Previously, it used to say that there shall be a representative of each party. It didn't mention who was going to pick out the representative. We felt that the party should have control over that. I would say on 269, Mr. Chairman, the best thing probably would be for us to try to answer any of your questions.
Okay, thank you. Good questions. Lieutenant Governor, Ms. Fisher?
Yes, I am going to go on, be very honest with you. But I know that in the various precincts, they were very resentful of the fact that they were not aware of the count before it left the precinct. They didn't know what their precinct count was just taken, and that was it. I know that's true precinct 3 and precinct 2, precinct 1. I don't know how this can be remedied, but I guess these people sit there all day and sort of anxious to find out how it's all coming out, and then, you know, it's all shoved into one batch, and they're, maybe it's because people dislike change, as I guess everybody is pretty difficult to change, but I know they deeply resented this fact.
You mean not knowing the outcome in the precinct?
Yeah, not knowing the outcome in the precinct before
I don't
where the ballots were
do
sent
it
out.
On a computer type operation, because it's up to the computer to sort out the vote. There wouldn't be any way to do that unless the computer was right there at the precinct. And of course, there just aren't that many computers. Isn't that right, Patty?
That's
just
true.
Wouldn't be any way to
once change. The election board members actually, they actually count the number of ballots that they have, and as they come out of the ballot box, they know how many are there, but of course they have no idea what the returns actually are until they have gone through the computer. And then of course, whenever the election board members bring the ballot box and the ballots from the containers in, then they're certainly free to stay and find out what their precinct return was.
I know, by the way, as long as I'm on that, and you know, we may not have a good chance to talk to you again. I understand there's a bill in or going in or is in or something that would lengthen the time. And I've had calls from people who have served on the voting boards and were said, you know, well, I know how hard it is to get somebody.
Yes.
They work, you know, those are long hours as it is. And if they lengthen out that time element any more than it is now, you're just not going to have anybody in precincts working.
Ms. Fisher, that bill is coming up on the agenda today. So we'll have a chance to finish that out.
I would even realize.
Yeah, 204.
Mr. Chairman, you may be especially interested in the last, well, it's section 730 of the bill on page 7. Talks about interpretation of ballot marks. And this goes right after the old problem of the gray area and whatnot. And I was just saying, passing, I don't see how that problem could ever arise again now that we've been through it. And according to this language, the computer would be programmed to pick up not only a vote where it's supposed to be in the little white box with the plus sign, but anywhere in that little rectangular box that's opposite the governor, lieutenant governor, president, vice president, whatever the case may be. But we also think the ballot can be better set up, no question about that now, the experience has been true. And here's one of a Hawaiian presidential ballot. And it's easy to see that you could also apply that to governor, lieutenant governor situation.
You got one of the old punch card ballots from the
yeah.
Hammond Egan race? You can
we sure
to
do.
See where we went wrong.
Yeah. Right, you bet.
It was.
The gray area situation, which was an outgrowth of an earlier problem they had, and they thought by graying out a portion of the card that nobody would possibly punch in that. But that's all it happened.
Well, those punchers, you know.
Well, we've got one
kind
right here.
Difficult to handle, too, yeah. In some of the areas. You know, 1901 defunct.
We have to keep checking and testing them during the day to make sure that they're still working properly.
I think, too, that there was some validity in some of the remarks made that some people wanted to vote, let's say, for Mr. Boucher, but not for his running mate, so they punched opposite his name, and that was out of the little white area. So if you put that white punch area in between the two candidates in the future, it might lessen some of that temptation. Of course, that could happen.
There's not enough space to put them both on the same line.
You've got to put a lot of information in there, just by law and office and party. So I really don't think that problem would ever arise again.
Are these the ones is this the one that you're planning on using?
The one in your left hand is sort of a demonstration of what we could do. So the punch would be in the middle. See, the problem had to do where you had two candidates, one vote for two candidates. The one on the right is the one that's the problem. Many people punched in the blacked out gray area, and the computer was not programmed to pick those up.
We would also anticipate having the arrow pointing to which block to vote in.
Right.
In the end, were those votes counted? People who voted in the gray?
Yes,
yeah,
they were counted.
Right. You know, Mrs. Fisher brought up a point here, and maybe I should ask you to grasp it. In the title, said punch card voting shall be used in state elections in any precincts where data process equipment is available. Does that mean to get picked in, but to which data processing equipment is available?
There's obviously not a computer in every precinct.
I think that the word precinct should go to the word area.
Got one of those here too. Okay. Or the word district was suggested in one amendment, I think.
However, with the six districts in Anchorage.
Yes, same problem.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Governor, I noticed in the procedures set forth for county, as you were saying to Mrs. Fisher, probably, you know, there's no way that you count them by computer at the polling places. But I don't see in here any procedure by where they, by where they have to total the number of ballots. And maybe you do this in your regular procedures, I'm not sure, but it seemed to me like it would be a very good idea to total it so that the total number of ballots that finally end up equal the number of votes that were counted, and, you know, the number of cards that were tallied in the ballot box when they came out.
What we actually asked the election boards to do is that the ballots, of course, whenever the voter returns them to the election board, are in an envelope. We ask that they count those envelopes to make sure that that number matches up to the people that they show voting, who actually signed the original register.
Would you see any value in putting that in the legislation? Or did anybody fail to do that? I don't know where I was in the last election. It seems to me I remember some criticism. People claimed that there were different totals counted than were filed. And
I think that probably went back to our whole area of the gray area. And of course, on election night, you know, we would show that there would be so many votes in that precinct. And then once you actually went back and looked, you would find that it was marked in the gray area and therefore did not tally on election night. So it would show a difference. And of course, people, when they vote, don't necessarily vote for every issue or candidate that they could vote on. So that, again, would make a difference.
Would there be any difficulty, though, in actually tallying up the number of ballots? Would people have any trouble with that?
This is part of our administrative procedure. It's not a part of our borough code, but it is an administrative procedure.
To clarify, is that done before the ballots are sent to the computer, or just before the ballots are sent to the computer?
Yes, yeah, the same number arrives, that'd be another check.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, they counted them on the site, and then sure as heck, that same number better arrive at the destination. I'm going to be valuing that part of the
I see no harm in it. It's a mechanical problem. I put it in. The more we can put it in the way of safeguards, I think the better. Get rid of the informality wherever possible.
Well, looking at that business about the gray area again, after I got a chance to look at those two ballots.
Hold on.
Is there any reason why, I've got before me a copy of the governor's ballot for the last election. Is there any reason why we couldn't have a large dark line or a fairly large gray area between each one of the candidates so that the computer can tell the difference, I guess, and that anywhere that the white space be larger so that anywhere in that white space that they marked would be counted? Would that be the
in the rectangle opposite the two candidates?
Anywhere in that, but I realize you probably have to have a fairly dark line separating the individual candidates for the machine to be able to pick it up, is that right?
Well, a computer can be programmed to pick up anything within that rectangle. Now, there comes a time, I guess, this machine, if you have your card properly in there, if you can't hit right on the line, you'd either be in the proper rectangle or out of it.
Well, I was looking now at the one from Hawaii. And it would appear to me that if it only counts where it's in between the lines where the plus mark is, that you still have the same problem that anywhere they get in that white area.
Yeah, but if you'll notice here, Senator, the way we've got it written, it would still pick up anybody straight away from that center punch spot as long as he stayed within the overall white rectangle opposite those two candidates.
Well, sure, it's sure still confusing to me, looking at the Hawaiian ballot. If you, now whether we're talking about voting from a governor or Nixon, and the way the line stops at the end of the, when you first come to the white area, and then goes on up, it would leave the question of whether this space here belongs here or belongs here, because the center line don't go through.
Well, it should go through. I agree with you. I didn't know that.
They didn't run the center line between Nixon and McGovern clear through, so you might say that they made a big no man's land there. What I'm getting at, Lowell, is that it would seem to me that there wouldn't be any room for mistake if you just had a decent-sized dark line between the two, and you said anywhere in the white, if you go over the line, you're obviously in the other guy's white area and you voted for the wrong man.
Sure, that's a good idea. You notice the ballot that was used last time, though, it did have the line go across.
It had the line go across, but the only reason I can see for having a great big gray area opposite the two candidates is that just somebody wanted to pick it up in a small area on the computer. It must have been a matter of reading, a mechanical matter, wasn't it?
Well, now the computer is programmed to basically pick up where the plus marks are in the white section. Anything within that gray area, it was not programmed to pick up.
But it could be.
But it can be, yes. Here, not a difficult problem at all.
It looks like somebody made a problem.
Well, trying to solve an earlier problem that developed to be another problem. Yeah. You'd be surprised how many mistakes voters make.
I can see where you might want a very heavy line between the two candidates.
Yeah, that was a dangerous part. 287 mistakes.
I know that you're as sensitive out of what you just said as anybody in the state is to that role, so I won't pursue it any further.
Well, we do think that 269 is a real step ahead just to put this thing in the code and get it out of the procedure manual.
Well, I think it's
are there more questions on that? Senate Bill 259.
Is this still in the State Affairs Committee?
It's in the Senate State Affairs Committee. I'm confusing why I was gathered for it, right? Because they don't have a quorum here, they don't have to take action on it at the same time. Lieutenant Governor, let me just a personal question about the bills. You know, the Attorney General, the formal title for him is not Attorney General, but just General. And when we see you like in the hall or here, should we just call you Governor?
Why don't you just call me Lowell? A lot better. As a former legislator, I'm
good answer.
What is the proper?
So with the governor too, except it's a little different. You know, I mean, he really has to maintain the dignity and decorum of the office.
What is it technically?
I suppose you're right. I suppose it's like Lieutenant Colonel is Colonel. I imagine so.
I think it's Governor. We had the problem with addressing letters to him that, but they said it'd be too confusing to have two governors in the same floor. So.
I don't
think
about it.
It's bad enough for the borough and the city.
I hadn't known them both before they went into that particular office. It'd be easier for me, but I can't make myself call them something besides Jay and Lowell. But I could do it when I write a letter.
Okay, are we ready to go to, you want to take up 300 next, right?
Would like to. Okay, well, 300, again, is an outgrowth of the meetings that we have. There were many recommendations following the last experience, little things that needed to be corrected. And again, Patty Ann has worked up the description here, section by section. I really don't know what in it might be of great concern, where the questions would tend to fall. It's a matter of residence and the definition of residence. Maybe Richard here would be care to just say a word or two about it, because people always wonder why you can't really tighten that thing up, you know. I guess there's some reason.
Well, we've all seen in recent years the courts to the United States Supreme Court principally, and the other state Supreme Courts have been very touchy on the subject of residents. We've seen the requirements going lower and lower and closer to election day as to when a person is able to cast a vote. So it's a pretty touchy area yet, but the same token, there have been particular problems throughout the state, especially in the Anchorage area in local elections and throughout, because of the difficulty of establishing what is a residence. And we have taken the language, which it doesn't do really anything new or different from what we had, but just adds to it a little, perhaps adds to the force of it in determining how we determine what residence is. This was borrowed from Hawaii as a state, I believe, which has this language, and it just leans a little heavier. We've had difficulty with these canvassing boards in adjudicating difficulties of residents, and they feel that unless the statutes are very explicit and very very heavy, they don't want to take decisions and disqualify certain voters because they feel the statute hasn't gone far enough. And we're hoping that making the language a little heavier here will encourage and give more confidence to the canvassing board in disqualifying a voter which has a problem of residency covered by this language. But actually, as you can see, and comparing it with the present language, it puts two lines into about six lines, hoping that it's going to make a bigger impression. But we are feeling all along is we can't do too much from the standpoint of residency because of the right to travel. We cannot demand duration of residency, and this is actually determining residency, and they have a few things which we didn't have before, such as business address and home address and home residence, those things which we didn't have and we think were maybe helpful.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
Wallace.
Well, yes. On page 6, section 9, too bad at the section there saying that there'll be no write-in candidates unless they've filed with you 10 days prior. There's some problem with that?
Right. The reason on that has been that the election people have just been inundated with Mickey Mouse, Napoleon, George Washington, things like that. And the only purpose here would be to try to knock out that type of thing that right now has to be recorded. Patty Ann, I think, has got a long list here.
Right.
To show you. Maybe it's
each one of you should have a list of the write-in candidates as tallied from the last general election. I think as you look through there, you will see the Mickey and Minnie Mouse votes for governor.
Yeah, I understand that it's a lot of nuisance, but isn't there something in the Constitution pertaining to a person voting for anyone of his choice, any person of his choice?
Well, with
there
this...
There may be. I can't really.
California has a similar statute, and their own court, one of their courts, has decided that since their constitution does not make any provisions concerning write-in votes, as ours does not either, that they feel it does not add a qualification, and they feel it's perfectly illegitimate for the legislature to take action in that area since their constitution does not. Now, that is the only case I'm aware of, but they've had the law for two or three, possibly 4 years, and that's the only case that's been brought up attacking that provision.
Mr. Chairman, I think Stu would like to respond.
But Mr. Peter, it isn't 10 days, isn't it? It's 5, isn't it?
Theirs?
Yes.
It could be, yes. I don't remember the exact
question.
So. Mr. Miller?
Well, I don't see anyone who'd write in. I see somebody in District 2 wrote my name in for U.S. representative.
That's darn enough of it.
Sounds pretty good, don't it?
Yeah. I've got a grassroots thing going. If people trying to cut me off the pocket.
Neil Lowell, seriously,
seriously,
as you look through these, there are a few Mickey Mouses and God help us, I see. But basically, I think these are serious votes that people think would be better candidates than the people who got nominated in the primary. And I think certainly everybody has been at least one general election, has had to vote on one general election where neither of the candidates are of all the people you think of are the ones who choose. It seems to me that people should have a right, and that's what the Constitution was aiming at.
I don't think it's a big thing, really, with the election people. It's just a nuisance.
Yeah, well,
they can continue to live with it, I'm sure.
I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed. I heard that Candy got some of my votes, and I can't find that it's true.
Surprising, some of the names that did pop up.
You know, neither one and none of the above, and so forth, have been several times. While the bill is not for us,
Tillian Bill?
I know you can't.
Doesn't Tillian have a bill in, or you
yes.
vote no?
And Mr. Miller and I have one in the House that.
That sounds fine. It's better than not voting at all.
Certainly is.
More people might actually turn out and go to polls if they could go and vote no.
Well, if no is elected, who gets seated?
Under our bill, there'd be a special election held, and there wouldn't be neither on those, since it's on that ballot. You'd have to choose one of the two in the second election.
Wouldn't that be terrible if no actually won? Chairman, I would call attention on page 4, I guess, section 170, appointment and privileges of watchers. There's something a little new. We felt that watchers ought to be entitled to go to the county centers, the computer centers. And there was no provision made for them last time around. It was not in the code, because there was nothing in the code really about the computer rooms. That's new. Also, I think this bill, toward the end, we propose in the candidate pamphlet, first of all, to formalize what I think was done in practice last time anyway because of financial problems. And that was just to send one pamphlet to a household to keep it identified like a man and wife, instead of sending two, send one, save the state a little money. And we got that in here, one per household, where you can tell by the address. Also, we have an amendment we would like to propose.
Mary, just talk about that one. I think there would be a lot of objection to that, because there are too many people that utilize those pamphlets in many ways. For instance, I could have used a couple of others rather than cut it down to just one per household.
I think the argument was finances. If the money is there, you pay for it, that's fine.
There would be additional booklets available through the elections offices if you need additional booklets.
I see.
Is it the general, your general impression that those got out pretty well last time, that most registered to the mail?
To my knowledge, they did, yes.
In my district, it seemed like they didn't. And maybe that's just a, it's my impression that they didn't get around through the mail very well in my district. Now, I don't know if that's just the people I talked to had moved more than normal or what.
Well, I believe they did run into a couple of problems in putting those out timely, as was required. One of them was a court case involving, I believe, Mr. Vogler and Mr. Petler, and the fact that their general statements regarding the American Independent Party was not in there, and they had to go to court to get that put in, and as a result, they were not timely mailed as a result of that court case.
Mr. Chairman, we would also propose an amendment there on the contents of the pamphlet over on the last page to include sample ballots, a sample ballot in a particular election district. And that would be, I should think, a very good way for people once again to be reminded just how they have to vote to be counted on this, especially the punch card ballots.
Just say again for me on this.
Right. To include in the candidate pamphlet a sample ballot.
Oh, yes.
In that particular area. That should be required.
Right, you might also include a better map of the district. Huh? The map that they had in there, it's pretty hard to read.
The other thing we had thought about putting in the pamphlet was a absentee ballot application, so that you could just take it out and...
Good idea.
And mail it in.
If they get there early enough.
Yes.
I got one for you. The system is sending out several different booklets. Could you could you comment upon the savings in pages on these and the other, the differences that you have, so many different types of booklets? What's your net savings and not, do you have any idea what the savings are and not just to having one booklet? Or if maybe it might truly go the other way, that one single booklet might be printed that might in the long run end up cheaper than having the district booklets?
I couldn't answer that. I haven't had that experience with that. I don't know.
You know, one of the things the booklet does provide, if it were complete throughout the state with the same booklet, it lets people in other districts know who's running for office in the other district. And very often we have voters have an interest in that. I've had all kinds of questions come from voters during the election. Well, who's even running in Anchorage? The only way I can find out in Anchorage is borrow a book from a friend of mine. But the book from the friend of mine wasn't even complete. So there was no way you could really find out what was going on in the rest of the state. Now, people besides candidates have some interest in that. And I realize that the intent of the legislature when we passed the law was, why give a lot of coverage to guys who might become statewide candidates by having it printed that way if it's going to cost more money? But I think there was some indication that having so many different booklets may have caused more confusion and work than just having one booklet work. And that's why I wanted to, that's the purpose of that question.
Can't really answer that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Fisher.
Well, I'd like to speak to that. I don't think it'd be a good idea. I think keeping it to the single districts is much better. I think it's people are confused enough as it is. And if they know who's running in their district, at least they have just before them the ones that are, and they can take a in-depth, much more in-depth study of those people that are running in their district than they could if they were looking over a big sample. I'm sure with the cost of living going up and everything else, you do find that the cost is pretty tremendous.
Mr. Chairman, there are two other things here we'd like to mention.
Okay, this bill, I have another question myself on the pamphlet before we get off that. More questions on the pamphlet. If we mail them to the household, what would you do about people registered in post office boxes? Now, some people have at least mailing it. But your mailing address is a post office box. Under the strict language of that, they wouldn't get a pamphlet?
No, because that would really be their or mailing address. And so if it was a husband or two people with the same last name at the same at the post office box number, then they would each receive a copy, or they would receive one copy of the pamphlet.
Mr. Peter, is that a drafting active, if we mean that? It says household of each registered voter, the amendment.
Well, by household, we meant in that case, family or couple.
I think I appreciate what you're trying to do, is duplicating
residents. Uh-huh.
But if the address is a post office box, a lieutenant governor could interpret that to not send it because he's obviously not a household. Is that right? Or is it legally, this household?
I don't think it'd be interpreted as not a household because it was a post office box, but it might be desirable, and I don't recognize, I believe that in the draft we had possibly address, and may have been changed, I just don't recall. But there would be certainly no objection to making an address, would it, though?
No, not at all.
What we wanted to do mainly was to get the person out of that, get voter out of that, and make it address so we could consolidate that.
I understand. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure you're not causing another problem considering the historic use of post office boxes in Alaska. It's different than it is in the other states. Most of you know that, I think. Now, there are times when a half a dozen people get their mail at my post office box. And that is very common throughout the state of Alaska, that people, their friends come here, and for years sometimes they use the other person's post office box for the simple reason that you can't get a post office. And so I don't want, because I let John Guerrero use my post office box number for 10 years at a time, I don't want me not to get my registered voter booklet or him not to get his.
Well, as long as his name was different from yours, you would each be getting one. Of course, if you took it before you got there, why, that's your problem. You would be each, if his name were the same as yours and not in your household, then you'd have a difficulty. You may be a second cousin whom you don't see, and if he got the book, you never would see it before election day, but for someone living in your own household with the same name, of course, you'd have a chance to pass it around.
Well, it's an information book, so I'm a little concerned that when we, anything we do to limit information. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, of course, the purpose of the statute is to get that information around as widely as possible. But they have a fiscal, it has a fiscal impact too.
Mr.
Chairman, I want to register again my concern about this. I think our responsibility is to the individual voter. Our responsibility is not to a husband and wife team, and it's not to a household. And I think that we're in error if we don't recognize that everybody is an individual and that they are entitled to the information which is to go out. And I think we're going to get lots of repercussions.
Well, that was done the last time, wasn't it? And I don't know, have there been repercussions?
Yes.
Do the election people know?
There have been people who did not receive it, and, or it was received as a joint, and where people are living individual lives now. They utilize this. This is for the purpose of being utilized when it comes.
No doubt.
So I think that we're underestimating the value of our instrument if we don't look upon it as being valuable for every individual rather than just two people or less.
So it's a cost. Basically,
yeah.
That's true.
Well, there's another thing, and I know many cases where couples are separated yet living under the same roof or using the same, or not living under the same roof and using the same address. Using the same address, so.
Well, again, that's not a big item there.
And then another question.
Yeah, I was just going to concur with Mrs. Byrne. Particularly, like, for instance, everybody looks at their own situation, but I've got a daughter going to college. I'm sure if you saw three Millers in a row on there, all box 1494, you just send us one. Yet, you know, we'd like to keep one at home at least and send one we forward her mail. So,
I think the gentleman on the finance committee.
Yeah. When you get up there, they'll go the other way. They'll say, select a random one out of every seven voters.
You're in the classic position of the legislature charging you with saving money, but not for
I think, you know, I raised the concern there about not getting the booklet. But I think maybe the concern is a lot better raised by Dr. Byrne. Because I've used the registration system for at least one first-class mailing in every election since the registration system has been on the books. I think maybe that's a little more than most other candidates have used it. And I have been sorely tempted, as the cost of postage goes up, to consolidate husbands and wives, because it's a lot easier than anything else. And each time I thought about that, I looked at it and I said, am I asking a part of a vote from each one, or what am I asking for? And I decided each one of these is a registered voter, and I'm going, even two goes to a household, I'm going to address it to the registered voter because it's the individual registered voter who I'm asking for a vote. And I think maybe we should, Dr. Byrne's concern ought to be one that we don't violate.
Mr. Chairman.
Fisher.
I'm going to have to leave for Commerce, which is that I did want to, number one, voice my objection to what's that bill, the length of the hours. And I hope that goes out of committee today, that give me a chance to vote and not pass.
Yes, I'll give you a chance to sign all the bills.
And the other thing is, while we have you all here, I hope something can be done. I think it was 4 years it was given to clean those books up, the registration lists. And I know people that have been living in California, and I know people who are dead and gone, you know.
And voting regularly.
You know, like Betty Eady's father left here a good number of years ago, and he died about 4 or 5 years ago now. He's still on there, you know. And I made a list, you know, and out of 6,000 and some that I sent out, I sent out 1 mailing in my district. I received 902 returns. Now that's pretty bad. And that is not a district such as Mr. Parker's, which is more or less a transit district. You wouldn't say that Inlet View and Turnigan and Sand Lake was transit. And so I hope that by the time the next election, and I publicly state a million times, I'll do it again. I don't plan on running, but I hope that it isn't that it's going to make it easier for the candidate, but it's a damn nuisance for the mailman. You know? And I hope that these cards can be pulled and something can be done about it.
Well, we just recently sent out a mailing of 16,641 letters to those people that, according to our records, had not voted in the past 4 years. And so we estimate 8,000 of those letters returned to us now. Most of them are addressee unknown, things of that nature. And we estimate that we have 2,000 returned with people basically wanting to remain on the list, even though they had not voted in the past 4 years. So,
well, I can understand maybe the Alicon or EO, or there could be many reasons. And I wouldn't want them wiped out just indiscriminately. But I was hoping that something could be done.
And you actually pinpoint a problem that we really do have with particular someone who is registered to vote here and then goes outside and actually dies outside, because their vital statistics does not receive the death certificate back for as long as 9 months to a year usually. And so some of them, they never come back. And that's why some of the deceased are on that list still.
I think an awful lot of them don't.
Mrs. Fisher, it's been estimated in Fairbanks by a former election official there who's very knowledgeable that up to a third of that list, Fairbanks, bogus. Hmm. You got people moving because of deaths, because of all different kinds of things. Which kinds of makes a mockery of the whole list.
Who's that kid?
And actually, raises the price of the cost of sending the pamphlet and everything else.
Mr. Chairman, could I mention just two things for
it? Okay, now we're getting some comments I see from the clerks.
Would you excuse me?
I guess mistakenly, because it says state elections, I'm passing it by and I don't want to do that. Ms. Coffey? Okay, Ms. Coffey, why don't you just say whatever you
Okay, pardon, I'm sorry.
Did you have a question on this bill?
I had a comment on Mrs. Fisher's remark, Senator Miller. There are two bills currently, Senate Bill 208 and House Bill 219 that will help in this situation. Both of them provide for a registrar at the polling place for every municipal, state primary, and state general election, so that when the voter comes to vote, finds that he is not on the list or has made a change of address, has moved and hasn't made that change of address, he will be able to do so if the bill passes at the time of voting, accomplishing two things. Number one, lessening his anger, and number two, serving to clean up the registration rolls. I think this will be a great benefit to those rolls. So there are those two bills.
Stu?
Well, I was just going to observe, Mr. Chairman, if I might, that while I agree that that might be a possible solution, that's only part of the problem. It occurs to me that in this state where the average residency is 3 years or less, and in a highly transient state, what really needs to be done is to cut down this purge period from 4 years to two, particularly where you're allowing people to register to vote after 30 days in the state. But I think that the amount of dead wood on the Alaska voter registration roll is incredible. Now, in my own particular case, I live in an apartment on North Douglas, which happens to have been previously occupied by my personal friends of Mrs. Fisher's. The wife of that particular couple died, and the death certificate was received by the state, and her name was taken off the voter registration list. But the husband's name has been on there since 1972, despite the fact that he has moved to Massachusetts and has voted both in there in 1972 and 1974. His name was still there in 1974 election. I was going to propose to the committee, if a staff member may be permitted to do so, that Section 1507.130B be amended. This appears in Senate Bill 308. It also appears, I think, a big part. It does appear in that bill to cut down the time period from four consecutive, when a registered voter has not voted in either a primary or a general election, at least once in two instead of four consecutive years, that his voter registration be canceled. Pending, of course, the use of his postcard, which is very common practice in some states, returning within 90 days to indicate whether he wishes to remain registered, and then provide, because of Alaska's rather unique circumstances, that if an election board in a precinct doesn't receive the required election materials to enable the board to conduct the election, and registered voters in that precinct to cast their ballots either in person or by absentee ballot, that primary or general election would not be counted as one in which a registered voter has failed to vote. In other words, what I'm saying is I think we need to do something in this state to effectively clean up the voter registration list. It's a serious problem, and I think that Mrs. Coffey has a sincere suggestion. I think that it only meets part of the problem, and it really won't clear as much of the deadwood from the master registered voter list as it should. And I think the combination of what she proposes and what I'm suggesting, and it does appear in Section 10 of Senate Bill 308, is the way to handle the problem. And I submit that for your consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I was just whispering to Patty Ann here, and she says, well, what about that person who only votes in presidential election every 4 years?
Okay.
That would be the value of her.
You're right. What we're doing is getting some good points on elections generally, but we're not getting through the agenda on the bills we have. I think, but I know that the clerks are here just for a short period of time. What I'll do maybe if it's all right with the committee is we'll try to just stick with the bills until we get to the bottom, and no matter what time that is, I'll stay, as many of the other members of the committee who want to can stay, and we'll take any general comments you have on the election procedures beyond these bills. Otherwise, what'll happen is we'll get through the day and not have any action on these bills, and then I'll catch heck from the leadership for not doing my day's work. So
blame it on the Senate.
I'll blame it on the Senate.
Chairman, 3 o'clock, I'm going to
All right.
We have a problem at 3 o'clock.
Two, we have a meeting. Okay. Lieutenant Governor Lowell, what else on National 300?
The two things I want to point out. Section 105, page 2, we provide for the appointment of the Director of Elections. It's amazing, but there is no mention of the Director of Elections anywhere now in Title 15. And I don't know how any administrative elections, Lieutenant Governor, whatever you call it, can get along without a statewide director and his or her team of people. It would just to me be totally impossible. In fact, it says the Lieutenant Governor may appoint a director of elections. I certainly see nothing wrong with changing may to shall, because it's going to happen regardless.
Page 2,
it's actually Section 8 in the bill. 1510.105. There is no mention now in Title 15, the election code, of any supervisor, or rather statewide director of elections. Then the other thing was that included in this bill are the requests of the court system, Mr. Snowden, and I think maybe you received a letter from him. He wants to try to get the courts out of administering elections. And it starts over at about Section 16 of the bill, designation of magistrates and others as election officials. So that really isn't our doing in there, but I don't believe we have any objections, provided the magistrates and the villages still are required to help out. But in the areas where there can be election officials, the courts want to get out of it. Can't blame them, separation of powers. Those are just the other two things I want to mention.
Okay. Does the bill end on page 10? It's a strange, it looks like the missing part of the...
It's amending a subsection, and of course the subsection ends in a semicolon there.
And just happened to come out of the bottom of the page.
Could be.
That's right, third of the
bottom. Second time it's happened this
That's
year.
Right.
Third. There's no mercy clause.
It does look like a mistake.
In a political novel, you can write a great chapter on that where somebody can rip a back page out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't be sure it hasn't happened.
Okay. Are there other questions on House Bill 300? I have two other ones that back on the first page. Below if I can. Line 16. 15 or 16, they have a week. If a person resides with his family in one place but does business in another, the former is his place of residence. Is that aimed at pipeline workers, or does it apply to pipeline workers? Do you know I have a personal...
I don't think we're aiming at that. It seems like this came out of the big lake problem, where people were switching around their residence for various purposes. What was it now? Some people living in Big Lake are claiming they had a residence there but working in Anchorage, or vice versa.
Well, this doesn't attack the Big Lake problem, which is one of recreational living. This, I think, is some of this Hawaiian language. And it wouldn't affect, I don't think it could, unless you were doing business in Big Lake, for instance, had a store out there or some sort of a concession and lived in Anchorage, it wouldn't affect that. But it's just to clarify a little the difference where a man does work in one community and live in another.
Yeah, Miss Itta, Brenda Itta, representative from Barrow, it takes, I don't know, you probably know, Patty Ann, how many people elect somebody in Barrow to the House?
Approximately 3,000.
Is it that many? Anyway, she brought this up to me one day after something, I guess after the finance day when you were up there, of all the people working on the slope chose to make that the district they voted in, that they could have a substantial impact because of the relatively small number of voters. I thought it was smaller than 3,000.
I believe it's approximately that.
Does this take care of that problem then? But does business in another? Would that include working for the oil industry on the North Slope?
I would certainly think so. Generally speaking, of course, it's difficult to say that a man working up there says, I have no residence other than the camp in which I'm working. But generally, he would have an address somewhere else in the state.
This is for a fellow who has her family.
Yeah. Yes.
But I would think under the next line, to the next line or so, that he could get around that still. He could claim the pipeline camp as his dwelling place, even though his family's down in Fairbanks.
If he wanted have to change after his residence, he could do it.
If the intention seems to be the thing that really carries
as if he establishes a dwelling place other than with his family with the intention of remaining there.
But at least then it would take the affirmative act, wouldn't it, Richard, of re-registering?
Yes.
30 days prior to the election, and I think that in itself would...
Just transferring the registration, I think. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Can't spend 30 days.
Right.
I think, if I may, Mr. Chairman, what you posed about Brenda Itta's problem, there isn't an answer for it. If everybody wanted to go to Point Barrow and actually establish a residence there once they was sworn that they was going to live in and had intentional living in it, and then promptly went over and worked at Prudhoe Bay, she most certainly could get herself a large group of people who would be her residents and be able to vote for, but I don't think that's going to happen because they have to establish themselves there with an intention of living there before they're going to be able to vote or whatever in the district.
Well, Representative Indersee, this is a real and present danger to when I...
Well, it's a danger inherent in the lessening of durational residency requirements.
Yeah, that's beyond our reach.
About the ad hoc groups a couple of years ago, who recall, there were going to be an onslaught of hippies in the north going to sway the Alaska elections. Now it's pipeline people they're afraid of.
Chairman, I think Barry has a comment on that.
Strange parallel, Mr.
We, as Municipal Parks and Municipal Courts Association, do endorse this bill. We have several problems with what now composes or comprises the definition of residency, which is simply 30 days in a tent. It leaves us with nothing. It affects our voters and it affects our candidates, just as it does Lieutenant Governor and his staff. We feel that this can only help with the Big Lake problem, with pipeline workers, with fishermen, with construction. We are very much aware of the problems that all of you have discussed around the table. And having worked with it year after year, election after election, this is a beginning.
What's the legal definition of family?
Well, it's a rather flexible thing, as we found out with the conflicts of interest, whether it's immediate family or extended family. What context usually it depends upon the surrounding portion. What section were you in? Had you in mind, Mr. Chairman?
What section?
Yes. I see in section two here.
Yeah. Page 1, line 16.
This case would be construed to mean immediate family. I believe spouse and children.
What about a person who doesn't have a family? A single person who lives in one place and does business in another?
Well, would the first sentence cover that situation?
Residence, of course, this is trying to establish, it's a definition of residence.
Yeah,
so you, unless you sleep on the job, or sleep at your job, why? As it be where your residence is, whether or not you have a family there.
I think the first sentence would cover that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that habitation is usually defined, as I understand it, to put it in the simplest terms, is where you sleep, not where you work. That's usually regarded as the appropriate place of residence. That may be an oversimplification, but I think that's by and large, and the place to where you intend to return, that working of these phrases all together, I think is the usual rule of thumb.
I wonder about one thing that changes in the words there. I don't think I got a problem, but I wonder about it. Let's assume that a family makes its home in more than one place for various reasons. Maybe it's a vacation home. Maybe it's an affluent family that can afford to live 11 months of the year in Hawaii or 10 months of the year in Sitka or somewhere else, and their home, their residence, their main place of living is in Fairbanks. Would the new language that you put in here preclude them from continuing to maintain and operating in such a manner that they say, Fairbanks is my home, it's always my home, even though I'm not spending the majority of the year there, even though I have established another home somewhere else which is not where I live? I don't see that you've done that, but have you?
I don't think so. If you go out of state, you may have a problem with legal residence.
I'm including those in that question. Let's say that the man has established a residence in Fairbanks, lived there all his life, and now he's spending 11 months of the year in Hawaii. He's not voting in Hawaii. He's not claiming it as his residence. He is, maybe he has business interests there. Maybe he likes the sun and the surf, but he's not done the things that make him a resident of Hawaii, and he maintains he's a resident of Fairbanks. Under your new language, have you asserted his right to vote and stay and be a resident of Fairbanks?
don't believe that was the intent, as long as he's still a legal resident of Alaska.
That's right. It seemed to me the other portion, which it doesn't show in this section here, where it, you'll find in the act, a person does not gain residence in any place or lose residence. I think it's under the portion called lose residence in section, or title 15, that there are provisions whereby you lose residence, and this wouldn't jeopardize that in any way as far as I can ascertain. As long as they did not vote in Hawaii or wherever they were.
Yeah. Are there more questions on 300? Lowell, what did we talk taking up the two that you named? You have, I assume, position or comments on the other four tools: voter registration, opening and closing the polls, time for opening and closing the polls, and absentee voting.
Well, let's see. I have to look at the bills.
Okay. The situation we're in is time-wise, it's nearly time for the Senate to move on. And
207. I don't recall offhand.
That's an activated voter registration.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, I do. I have a reaction to that one. All right. That really is removed registration. And I think then you get right back into an argument whether you want voter registration or not. I don't really see that it serves much purpose to, if they can register as they go to vote, that you haven't registered at all. You know, you have to, I think, ask the reason for registration. And there was a presidential commission, I think, the President Kennedy Commission in the 60s to try to increase voter participation in the United States. And it saw registration as one of the means of getting more people to vote. Theory being, you get them registered, then they're more likely to go and do something about it when the time comes back to vote. Number one. And then number two, of course, was to try to avoid any election fraud, multiple voting. We had some terrific wrangles over that in 67, 68, as Terry will remember. Even Mike Gravel was in favor of, I shouldn't say even, he was in favor of voter registration. As I see it, if you enacted this, you would really be wiping out registration. I wouldn't be for it.
We got a record of how many people come to the polls, but because they're not pre-registered, don't.
Mr. Chairman, the election boards are instructed that anybody that comes to the vote, to the polls, shall be allowed to vote. And then they vote a question or a challenge ballot if they're not registered.
But if they're not registered, the vote's not counted.
That's true.
How many people, is there a way to retrieve the information? How many people is that?
We could find out, yes.
And what about how many people register within 30 days of the election? 29 days before the election. Is there a way you can do that?
That one would be a little more difficult to tackle, but I could certainly find out how many are not registered.
And you see, I'm one of the sponsors. What happens as you, and Lowell, you know this, of course, when you go door to door, the most heartbreaking thing in the world is to get somebody to say, thank God, I'm for you, you know? And there's 29 days left, and he says, I'm going to vote for you. And you say, of course, you're registered. And he says, registered?
Yeah, I know.
And it's hard to know how many people that is. But it seems, maybe they just stick in my mind, it seems like quite a number of people when you're campaigning. And I saw a study someplace, I guess I'll see your study and raise your study, that said that 40%. That the voting list, the number of voters would be 40% more if pre-registration weren't required. Now, I don't know about the Kennedy study, but if there is even one person to vote and hasn't registered 30 days before, there are bound to be more people. You would be bound to increase the number of people voting and have that vote valid if you didn't require pre-registration, right? Leaving aside voter fraud. I mean, registering people to get them to vote isn't working. What fraction of registered voters voted this time?
Fairly close to 60%.
Okay, that means
statewide.
40% were registered and still didn't vote.
The only problem with that is, well, I see what Trent said. She's saying 60% of 100%, but 100%, a lot of those people are bogus figures. because you don't purge your list often enough for one reason or another. And I don't, so I think that's probably much higher than 60% of real voters on the list. The question you're trying to ask is how many of the total population of Alaska who are eligible to vote in other respects are registered? Do you have any idea?
Who are eligible to vote?
In other respects.
Are U.S. citizens, well, are 18?
In other words, how of the population of Alaska, what of those who are eligible in other respects, they're 18, they live in the state for 30 days, they meet all the requirements. How many of those are registered to vote?
92.5% in 72.
And how many of them voted in 72? About 60%.
The national average was 75. We were 92. That's thanks to Mr. Boucher.
All right, and I appreciate that, but what I'm wondering is, so what? I mean, we're getting them registered.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
But they're not voting, at least. Some fraction of them, a significant fraction of them, still don't vote.
We're doing better than the national average, though.
On voting?
I think we did.
Do you think if we didn't require pre-registration, we would have as many people voting?
I think we'd have fewer.
I think we'd have more because of the people who come into the polls to vote, and we can have those figures pretty soon, huh? But haven't registered. What this bill, of course, would allow is it doesn't repeal voter registration. That was temptation to me, but I'm not
pretty well.
But I'd said it. What it does do is less the guy who didn't get around to it 30 days before still register and vote at the poll. And then he's registered for next time. Takes that 30 days out. When I, in my, from what I can tell, is when most people get interested in politics 30 days before an election. That's a crucial time, as you know, that from your. Somebody on your staff was a media expert. That's the time when you buy your media. That's, I mean, that's when people are making up their minds, someplace in that 30 days before the election. And that is the time that the state says, I'm sorry, if you haven't already registered, you can't vote this year. And that's just, I you know, that goes down very hard.
I know what you're saying. But I still think, though, that then you might just as well remove registration, really, if you do that. That's just not much purpose served. Get them on your list anyway. Just in passing, there are 45 states with permanent registration, and as to how much time is allowed in which to register, 24 states, closing a registration is within 27 and 35 days. That's 24 states have that way. 9 states have 0 to 26, and 4 states require to register between 36 and 50 days, or whatever that means. But anyway, the average is somewhere around 30 days as a cutoff, and for most of the states, 24.
Okay, so for a state that does have a registration statute, but it does say 0 to 9, well, some, at least one state has 0, huh? Okay, that would have Alaska join that state or states, whatever it is. So it would still be a state with a voter registration program,
yeah,
but without any cutoff before the election.
Yeah, there are 9 of those that are within the 26.
Did you meet people like that in the campaign who said I'll vote for you, but I'm not registered?
I met a few. Yeah, I think some of them probably were kind of nice. Say, well, we'd vote for you if we could, you know, that kind of thing. I got some of that. I'm sure you did too.
Yeah, I also had people say I'll vote for you, and I knew they wouldn't. But
sure.
But these people, I think, sincerely were ready to vote, and sort of, you know,
there always are some
mowing the grass and making his payments, didn't get around to registering before
that. Right, but then you run into that other thing, and that's that old bugaboo of multiple voting and that kind of stuff that we were worried about that way back 10 years ago.
Which is still possible to do a multiple vote under the present system, isn't it?
But less possible.
Yes, that's true. It's
hard. These folks who are the experts would really know better.
I agree, it's harder to work. Okay, do the clerks have any comment on that? Yes, ma'am.
I'm Judy Slazer from Rural Michigan. I'd like to ask you a question. Do you want the man that has lived in Alaska 15 days to be able to vote for you?
I didn't want to ask that.
If he wants to vote for me, I'd be glad to have it, but no, I
don't want it.
So what I'm saying, if he goes into the polling place, and registers and votes, then the burden of proof is on the state or the local government to say that he didn't, he lied when he said he lived there for 30 days. But if he has had to register at least 30 days before the election, his body, physical body, had to reside or be there to do it. See what I'm saying? So in that 30-day thing, you somehow protected these problems that you're talking about in Darrell and Nolan and the pipeline people, and you know what I mean? You're getting, there's some, this 30-day thing has got a built-in.
He would still have to break the law to vote for him if he hadn't been here in 30 days. You understand that?
But then the burden of proof is, you know, way all over the state or local government to say, you know, you might have 15, 20, 40, 50 people that have to go check, and sometimes for canvas, you're going to have to determine whether they were eligible or have been there for 30 days.
Of course, in Ketchikan, I guess, is another place of the state. You take everybody's word for that they arrived in the state anyway. I realize the point you're making is, if he has to register 30 days before he's here, he obviously was here 30 days. I mean, before he voted, he obviously was here 30 days before he voted, right?
So that's why I ask you whether you want him to be eligible to vote for you or not. If you don't, then you're going to have to build in something to have some protection there.
Well, to be honest with you, since the court ruling, we're virtually without protection anyway. Can't you register by mail?
Yes, you can.
But he's declared his intent at least 30 days before the election, too.
And he cannot vote in another municipality anymore since he's declared that intent.
Yeah,
it is the built-in protection of communities. Without registration, without a 30-day time period for registration, as Lieutenant Governor had pointed out, sure, back to the days of 10 years ago when carloads of voters were picked up, not only going from polling place to polling place in a municipality, but from one municipality to another, Anchorage, Palmer, Bigland, Wasilla, right on down the road.
Of course, every time they voted, you'd have to sign your name, right?
If someone were to register on election day,
right,
and also wish to vote at that time, and sign in on the original register, are you assuming that with passage, what the bill includes is that the state would then have to check to verify that each of those people did in fact physically exist and that address is indeed correct?
The same you do now is that you get a voter registration thing in the mail.
Then why, until that checking is done and those qualifications verified, those ballots could not be counted? That voter would have to vote a question or challenge ballot.
No. Now, if he registered, filled in the blanks with the right information, he'd be a qualified voter.
He's swearing to something, but there is, as Judy has said, there is no proof, none at all, that he in fact, or that Mary Coffey does exist at such and such an address.
What proof do we have now that Mary Coffey exists if she sends for her voter registration in the mail?
You can at least have 30 days in which to go back, check vital statistics, check residence addresses, utility billings, so on and
so
forth.
Is that done now?
Verify that. In some instances, yes.
So how do you choose who to check? I mean, that's a
suspect.
But what constitutes a suspect voter registration form?
Someone questioning or challenging
our
registration.
Now, couldn't we apply that to the same thing?
Felony.
You know, if there are 6,000 votes in the district, there were only 3,000 last time, then I suppose that would be suspect.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
The point is that the state now, in the 30-day plan cutoff, takes people's word for it unless they're challenged that they have been here, that they're U.S. citizens, they're such a person, all those other things, right? But most people aren't challenged. So you get an application in the mail, it's been filled out, and there's a signature. You have no idea whether or not there's really somebody on the other end of that like that, do you? Unless he's challenged, he gets to vote.
Whenever we have a registration, somebody applying by mail for voter registration, they come in on a letter or a cards that we have in the offices. Those arrive in, and then we have then in turn an address, name and address, that the card has to be mailed back to you for completion. And then it's the filled out card is returned to us. But we are at least assured that there is, the address does exist if the person is registered by mail.
course, you can tell whether the address exists or not other ways. I mean, there is a 917 Cordova Street in Anchorage. Whether or not that was my residence or not, you don't know. Well, something lost and something gained by voter registration and by repealing the pre-registration compulsory part. And I guess, I suppose we can spend the rest of the day talking about that. I had this feeling last time, and I've got it again, and I, the more I think about it, the more ways you can think of to defeat the present system, too, if you want to.
Bill, I got a comment on something that you raised here. Because every year, I maintain a booth at the Tatnall Valley Fair, whether it's an election year or not. In election year, I call it a campaign booth. Otherwise, I call it a legislative information booth. And this last year, I decided, so many people come up and have coffee with me and say, well, I can't vote for you, but I'll stop and talk with you anyway. So I thought this has happened for so many years that I would start asking them just exactly what you raised, Bill. I was curious. Why? And so never last year, during the, that's just before the primary. Of course, this time I had to make primary for the Senate. Of course, didn't have any competition that helped. So I asked every single one of them who said that, why? And I got an answer from everyone. Well, I really live in Minneapolis and I'm only here visiting. That was one. Another one is, I live at Fort Wainwright. Well, that's one of my precincts. Can't you vote for me there? Oh, but we'd have to give up our residence back in Michigan. Every single one gave me an answer. And that's the only year I've asked that. I thought that I'd kick that in for the information I was here. Then I had something I wanted to raise, an issue. It's relatively along the same subject. When we're checking the accuracy of our lists, I've got as many return things as you have. I've sent so many out. But I found this to exist. That you have a bulk mailing, as I understand it, but returns are paid for and requested. They don't throw them in the garbage, right?
Right.
But it's not handled as first class mail.
No, only the mailing out of the voter acknowledgement cards goes out by first class mail, and we pay the first class mail to get it back. Person is not there, if he sends it back to us for correction. We pay first class both ways.
So you get the same thing that I got. All right, now here's what I found. I found that even getting first class mail treatment at the post office, when it came to your voter information list, they were on the lower class mail, and they weren't getting the attention that my first class mail got. But that, leave that out, it's slightly beside the point. I found out that of 2,500 returns out of fairly early mailing, now this was 2,500, 7 bags of returns. I went through 50 or 100 letters in the 7 bags instantly, because I thought, my God, the registration list hasn't gone this bad. I know about how bad it is, I think, because I've made mailings all the time. And I found names like that have been there all their life that were sent back to me, and the postal carrier had marked on them no box, no this, no that, and some of them was like Fred Pope on Badger Road, and it's a business there, and his residence too, and all of his mail goes there. But the postal employee doing the delivery had decided that there's so many of these, there's something less than first class mail. You may be getting that kind of treatment too. And so therefore he found an excuse not to deliver it and send it back. And when I went through 50 of these and found out of the 7 bags full that came back, as a great surprise to me, I immediately went to the postmaster with the 7 bags in my car. And I said, hey look, out of 50, I personally have found 7 or 12 of these here that I can take right out there and deliver right now. And I says, I've called the people on the phone, asked them if they're still getting their mail there, and if that's correct. Now I says, something is wrong. So you're bound to have, other people are bound to be having the same kind of trouble. The postmaster says, we're very sorry, Mr. Huber. We'll take the 7 bags back in and sort them. Out of the 7 bags they took back in and sorted, when they got done this time, put them through a second time, there was about two-thirds or one-third of those, about one-third of those that came back, indicating that I was getting something besides proper mail service out of the... Now, a lot of people are bound to be getting that and bouncing it back here and saying that the registration list is, to excuse the term, even worse than it is. I don't think it's that bad. Well, that's support, or what you might call it, but you must be getting some of that too.
Senator Huber, we are. In fact, as we periodically go through the mailings as they're returned to us, we can pick out people or names that we know and give them a call on the phone. Isn't this your correct address? Yes. Well, as you said, address the unknown, or no box at this address, something along those lines. And we know the people are there. How many people this is actually happening to, I don't know.
And they're getting mail at that address every day. It's a correct mailing address, and the people running the post office are giving us that poor service. Well, they raise the price.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go and make an airplane here. I'm supposed to get out of town, but I doubt it.
Good luck, Paul.
Better try anyway.
Thank you for coming.
Looking at the other list, I really don't have any particular comments. And
opposing the polls.
Any and the experts are the ones to really tell you what it would mean, what the implications are there.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet.
Is there any, oh, pardon?
Before you leave House Bill 207, I'd like you to think about the effects of that bill on the list, the registration list, because I think it's as long as you're going to have voter registration up until the day of election and still have the mechanics of keeping election lists, what you're doing is going to have just worse, a lot worse lists. They're going to exist, but they're going to be a lot worse than they are now. And those lists are used not only by those people working in the precinct on election day, but they're used when we have petitions and referendums and recall. And every candidate that runs for local office, and I'm not familiar with how you file for state office, but we have signatures. We check signatures against voter registration lists. And if you go out, and if it's 25, 50, 100, 200 on a referendum in our town, it's maybe 1,500 or whatever, and you go through there, and these people take it all the time to circulate these petitions and go find that this person isn't registered, this person isn't registered, this person isn't registered, because you build into your registration system a deterrent from registering.
Which is what?
Means that you're going to have just...
The ability to vote without being registered before? Right. Well, I know a little bit about petitions, and I don't think you're right about on that point. The person has to be a registered voter at the time he signs the petition, right?
And the only thing we have to check against is the latest registration list.
Yeah, but you can tell when he was registered from that list.
No, not from the list.
Well,
no.
Some of the people you left on our ones last year, the initiatives, are
right.
Were thrown out because they weren't registered at the time they signed the list.
Right.
Well, the fellow who signs the list the day before the election but isn't registered and still votes, well, you're right, have his name on the election, but you're wrong, his signature won't count, and we can tell that from the list because we've got the day he registered on. Isn't that right?
Mr. Chairman, on...
Am I missing the point?
Actually, we, in elections, would actually have the voter cards that had been filled out. Judy in Ketchikan has nothing but a list to depend on. She doesn't have a signature or a card or something along those lines to check on.
But what petitions are checked other than in the Capitol?
Well, for any petition in her borough.
Everybody runs for local office. Everybody
all falls under this.
Well, that's a technical problem. We can get her the date.
No, what I'm saying is there's so many people running around that would be eligible if you didn't loosen up the registration, would have been registered. would be eligible to sign, and what we're going to find is a lot of people that signing petitions that aren't going to register until election day.
Right.
And what I'm saying is all these people are available to sign petitions but aren't legally can't sign them, and we have to refuse a lot of petitions anyway because they're not sufficient signatures, and then you're just going to be increasing this. See what I'm saying?
You're making it twice as hard for someone to circulate an initiative petition or a referendum petition and to have it get on the ballot. Right now it's difficult enough with 1,500 or 2,000. Without 30 days, if I sign an initiative petition today, but I don't register until the next election, because I think, what the heck?
Right.
I can always go in and register at the next election and vote. I don't have to register to do that.
Your signature
wouldn't
count.
You're making it twice as hard, right, and you're making it twice as hard to get those petitions.
No, I'm not. I'm not having any effect at all on it.
Yes, you are, because we're deleting those off of those initiatives if they're not registered on the registration.
But you do that now. You have to be a registered voter to have your signature count on the petition, don't you? You're saying that there'll be fewer registered voters because the natural instinct of people to put things off till they just have to.
Yes.
There'll be fewer registered voters around before the election.
Yes.
And because that's true, it'll be harder for a petition circulator to find people who have pre-registered. But anyone who voted in the last election will have already registered. Anyone who chooses to pre-register will have been registered. The only people who a petition circulator will find to sign who won't be registered then, who would have been if we didn't change the law, will be the person who was voting for the first time in Ketchikan, but would have done it 30 days earlier than he would have had to. Right?
The person who moved from Ketchikan to Anchorage, or Anchorage to Fairbanks, or all over.
It's a first-time voter in Ketchikan, right? Because if they voted before in Ketchikan, they're registered, and their signatures are on the list, and their signature on the petition will be valid. If they're a first-time voter in Ketchikan, and they signed the petition, but because of the 30-day because we repealed the 30-day cutoff part, and they, because of the natural instinct, don't register until election day, you lose that fraction of people. You lose 30 days worth of people. That's what you lose. You make it that much harder. What you gain is 30 days worth of people who would have been disenfranchised from voting otherwise.
I don't believe that's true. In the last borough election, which was held 1 month ago, you're talking about people who show up at the polls and cannot vote because they're not on the registration list. They have not pre-registered. We had 17,000 voters turn out, which agreed is a small turnout. Of 17,000 voters, we had 27 people showed up who were not registered.
Yeah. Of course, I think it's generally known that there is a cutoff.
Yes, right. It is much less today. We have fewer and fewer voters with each election that turn up who are not registered, simply because registration is now longer a brand new thing. Each year it will get better and better and easier and easier. The voter has become accustomed.
See, look, rather than I'm willing to stay on if you are after the meeting, we can talk about that. That's my bill, and we're getting into the, I think, the rest of the committee is for it. What about the opening and closing of polls?
Big mess they are.
I think they should be.
What time do you think they should be opening?
Well, somebody's proposing, I noticed in here, 7 o'clock in the morning, and they want the poor old poll worker to stay there. Well, it's 9, I don't know where to go.
It's
9:30.
One's
9:30.
Right.
I think the... I suspect the intent is to get the closing hour earlier and still get the voter, about the same length of time. I know that there would be more time to count, but the bill that wants to close it at 6:30 in the evening. Oh, wait. 6:30 in the morning.
One bill adds an hour to each end of the schedule, another adds an hour and a half to each end of the big.
From, I think, an election standpoint, we think that there will be problems in getting election board members to come and serve at the polls on election day. the hours are long enough now, and then when you get toward the end of the day, it's when you particularly need your election boards to be, you know, fairly sharp. Well, we've extended that opening longer, and so they're even tireder than usual. And then many of the people who actually serve on the election boards are housewives and things of this nature, who normally have children, husbands, to get out of the house and off to work before they can come to the polls. And we think that we may have really problems in getting the election boards. And there is the one section in the statutes now which says that if a person does not have 2 hours sometime during the day in order to vote, that he can take time off from work to go vote. So someone that was working a 12-hour shift or something of this nature would have an opportunity to go vote. And we also have a problem, particularly in the rural areas, where we have problems keeping the election boards there for 12 hours. And I can see that they probably are not going to keep those polls open for 14, 15 hours a day when we have problems getting them open for 12 now.
Yeah, why are they open for 12 hours?
8 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Ms. Chairman, as a countrywide, we don't have any problem with the hours, except that maybe they're a little bit too long now. So you must have a city problem for whoever put these bills in. I'm not prepared to comment.
I put this,
I'm not familiar with the problem.
Here's the problem. The guy lives, as a lot of people do, and people commute, is for, the guy's a commuter. Basically, here's the problem. Too small a fraction of the eligible people are voting in Alaska. That's what all these bills are trying to do, get more people involved. Figure out. This problem is, a guy lives in Palmer, or a guy lives, I suppose, does anybody drive to Hope and back every day? Not for very long, years. Okay, there are a lot of people who live in the valley. That's their home, and that's where they vote. They work in Anchorage. And for one reason, so they have to get up, I don't know what time will they get up, they're supposed to get up at 5:30, and they have to leave at 6:30, and they drive for an hour, and they go to work at 8, and so forth. For one reason or another, a lot of those people aren't voting. And we're trying to make it easier for them by making the time when they're at home, which is beyond 8 and 8, a time when they can vote there. So,
you know, Mr. Chairman, there are people that won't, you know, if you leave it open 24 hours, they just simply won't be able to get around to doing it. And I think that if you leave it open later in the evening, those clerks who have a horrendous job, you know, wind that thing up. I think it's an imposition into the time there.
It is
about intolerable.
Of course, we're running the elections for the people to vote, not for the clerks, you know.
Well, I suspect you could say, well, we could have two shifts of clerks.
Yeah. We've also raised the salaries, you see, the wages. It's kind of.
In answer to your question, that is a problem. We have the same thing occurring with people who live in Eagle River, but prior to the time they became Elmborough, and working in Anchorage, which is a considerable drive back and forth. There are two solutions to that problem. Number one is the 2 hours, as Patty Ann has said. A part of the problem is that the businessman does not tell his employees that that is available. Naturally, I can't blame him. He doesn't want abuse of it. But that is one solution. The second solution is that if I live in Eagle River and I work in Anchorage and I cannot possibly make it to the polls, I can vote absentee prior to election day. The increased cost for 6 years in Anchorage, the polls opened at 7 a.m. Surveys were taken during that period for each election. It was found that at the most, 2 voters per precinct, and that was the most, came out to vote between 7 and 8 a.m. Meantime, we were paying 4 women for 75 precincts, a total of 304 women, $3.50 an hour. You're talking about several thousand dollars.
What time did you close it in Anchorage?
8 p.m., 7 a.m. to 8 p.m.
So you had an hour at the start of the voting.
And after 6 years and after survey, we came to Juneau and it's now 8 to 8. We really feel, from the experience that we have, that there is sufficient amount of time for a voter to vote. We bend over backwards to make sure that every voter gets a chance, which includes hospitals, jails, nursing homes, the whole program. We have very little complaint on it. People with families and children, young children, are in bed or at home, and the kids are getting a bath and getting ready for bed at 8:30 at night. And those people will not be leaving their homes tomorrow later.
We've never tried an hour on the evening yet. So.
Not my recollection.
I have to say that's pretty convincing. If we've already tried it in Anchorage and it didn't work. What is the pattern? How many people vote up towards the 8 p.m.?
The mass of voters comes, you start getting, there's a few in the morning, there's quite a bit at noon on lunch hour. On the way home from work is when you get your voters, 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock on, since 4:30 are hours that leave. Once the voter reaches home, you generally will not go back out to vote. Unless it's falling place, say it's a nice summer night and he can walk a block. Once he gets home into his supper and his family and his newspaper, he doesn't generally want to go out and vote. Housewives will vote while the children are in school or if the infant is young enough.
What I mean is, do you keep records of when people, what time of day they
vote?
What is the hour like between 7 and 8 p.m.?
Pretty heavy.
And you keep the polls, if there's a line, 8 o'clock, you don't say go home.
No.
You miss it, right? Now, that's, I live across the street from the school where the voting is, and I notice a big line at night, and they're anxious to take them in. In fact, some people arrive after the 8 o'clock thing, get in line, so that's really where the attraction came on this thing, to me, is there are, I think, we pick up.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
You're saying the same guy would show up at 5 minutes to 9.
Precisely. You know, if you keep it an hour and say, hey, the door closes at 9, you know, you might win. But otherwise, you know.
I'm sure Alaska Airlines likes to sit out here and have meals and tell everybody's in their seat. And the whole plane is full before they go to Anchorage, but they got to run the schedule.
Good point.
Be honest with you, you don't hear my Alaska Airlines pitch, do you?
Do you want to hear our pitch on increasing the wages from $3.50 to $5? We didn't go along with that either.
So far, you haven't stood for any change in the election system,
oh, yes,
have you?
We have.